You're now listening to Sound Talent Media. Check out more shows at soundtalentmedia.com.
Episode number 68 of That One Time on Tour is brought to you by the band Longword. Formed in Seattle during the rainy spring of 2017, Longword is a fusion of punk, prog, and hard rock. Drawing influences from bands like Propagandhi, Lagwagon, and Melancholin, Longword's combination of driving rhythms and social commentary style lyrics hit the sweet spot for a melodic, progressive punk rock sound. Their debut EP, recorded in Seattle at Titan Recording Studio by Scott Michael, was released in April 2018. They're currently working on a new full-length album, due to be released in the spring of 2020. For more information on the band, check out longword.bandcamp.com. That is longword.bandcamp.com. Or on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Longword Band. Now here it is, their new single, A Visceral Assembly.
A fallen mastermind, hoorah! Besides the freeze kind, and under the spell of aggression, he will. We have all done hard time, so roll assembly, can remind those who have gone cold.
This is Tom from Big Wig and The World's End, and you're listening to That One Time on Tour.
Run for the road, cause it's going on and on. We'll be driving through the darkest night until the break of dawn. We'll be heading for the cities, another show for us to play. To get back in the bank tomorrow, we'll do it. We'll do it all again.
everybody out there in podcast land. What's going on? This is Chris Swinney. As always, I am your host for That One Time on Tour. This is episode number 68. Can't believe we've done 68 of these things, man. It's crazy sometimes to think back of how many great guests we've had on this show. Today, my guest is none other than my good friend, Mr. Tom Petta from Big Wig and his new bluegrass project, The World's End. It was such a good time talking to Tom. I hadn't talked to Tom for a very long time. We toured together back in the day in Canada. My first band, Chronic Chaos, opened for Big Wig a few times back in the day. And we had a wonderful conversation. And I want to thank you guys for coming last week and checking out the episode with Ray Carlisle from Teenage Bottle Rocket. I just wanted to give a shout out to Ray. His son Milo just had a birthday, so happy birthday to Milo. And Teenage Bottle Rocket currently are on the Fat Wreck Tour with Clowns, this really cool band from Australia, Mean Jeans, and Gin Pop from the Bomb Pops doing a solo acoustic set. The guys from Mean Jeans and Jen from Bomb Pops are actually going to be future guests on this program. So make sure if the Fat Wreck Tour is coming to your town, go check it out and tell Ray and everybody that Chris from That One Time on Tour said, what's up? So, yeah, that's what's going on here, man. I'm going to keep this intro short. On the program today, like I said, Mr. Tom Petta from Big Wig. It was such a good conversation, and I'm going to get into that very, very soon. Before I do that, I want to pay some bills. At the beginning of the program, you guys heard the band that sponsored this episode, Longword, out of Seattle. They're really, really cool. You guys need to check them out. Go to longword.bandcamp.com and tell them I said what's up. If you want to become a band sponsor, or if your company wants to become a sponsor for an episode or two or whatever, hit me up, TOTOTpodcast@gmail.com. I also want to say what's up to our friends over at Merge 4 Socks. They make socks. You've heard me talk about them. I know some of you guys have purchased some of their awesome socks, but you know, they've got Foo Fighters socks and Circle Jerk socks and Sublime socks and socks by professional skaters, and Rick Thorne has his own socks. And I hope, Rick, if you ever listen to this, I hope you're doing a lot better, man. I know you're recovering still from your accident you had. And Rick has a good podcast. Hopefully it'll be back up soon as well, called The Rick Thorne Show. But if you want to get some Rick Thorne socks, go on over to merge4.com. And we are going to be doing this contest. I know I talk about it all the time. I haven't given the details out yet, but it is coming very, very soon. It's our Patreon-only exclusive contest with Merge 4. If you want to be eligible, go on over to our Patreon. It's patreon.com/TOTOT podcast. Get involved at the $5 level, and you will be eligible for that contest as well as all kinds of other cool exclusive content. And I do want to give a shout out to Punk Rock Bob Foster, one of our patrons. He upped his pledge last week, and I said it went from $5 to $10. It actually went from $10 to $15. So shout out to Punk Rock Bob Foster. Check him out at Punk Rock Bob Foster on Instagram. He wanted me to let everybody know that he's single. So ladies, head on over to his Instagram and check him out. What else? Let's see. Permanence Tattoo Gallery, my favorite tattoo shop in Indiana. My buddy Jacob Harrison over there is the owner. And you guys need to go there. If you're in central Indiana or if you want to travel to get some good work, their artists are amazing. They have the best prices. The shop is such a cool shop. You need to check it out. It's on Meridian Street over in Anderson, Indiana. You can find them on all of the platforms at Permanence Tattoo Gallery. So that does it for the sponsors. I do have a segment I'm going to try out today. I'm going to keep it kind of short. But my friend Brian Nelson, he's going to be on the show soon, hopefully. He used to play bass for the Ataris. He was in my band, The Widow Jenkins. Brian has been one of my best friends since the beginning of time. And we used to own a recording studio called The Gallows Recording Studio. And our recording studio was haunted. It really was. And since I love paranormal stuff, and I listen to paranormal podcasts as well as music podcasts. And the funny thing is, at the end of this episode, Tom and I actually talk about the Jersey Devil, because he lives up close to the Pine Barrens in New Jersey. And if you know what that is, then you'll get a kick out of it. But I wanted to start this segment once in a while. I'm going to do it called Ghost Stories from the Gallows. And this is a story. And there were many people that saw this happen. I'm going to keep it brief, but this really happened. And hopefully when Brian's on the show, we can tell some more ghost stories from the gallows. But and in my recording studio, I had this little ledge at the back of the live room at the top. It used to be a garage door, but we walled it over so we could make it into a live room. And there was probably a 5 or 6 inch ledge at the top of the wall. And I had like all kinds of cool stuff, like Jay and Silent Bob figures and some Star Wars stuff. And I had my collection of like every Iron Maiden action figure ever made. And I had the big, like 2 foot tall Eddie Somewhere in Time action figure that, like, when you hit the button, he like shot his laser and moved his arm. And the thing weighs a lot. The thing weighs probably a good 5 or 6 pounds. But all these things were up on this ledge. And that Eddie doll was kind of like leaning back against the wall, fighting gravity. You know what I mean? Like it was leaning backwards. We're showing our friends the new live room. We just got done, you know, putting up the drywall and everything and decorating and painting and everything. And we're all standing in this like big circle in the middle of the drum room, the live room. And we heard this weird noise. And all of a sudden, Eddie, that big, like 5-6 pound Eddie, like 2 foot tall doll, flew off of the shelf, fighting gravity, flew off the shelf and landed in the middle of the room between all of us. There was probably 6 or 7 people there. We all saw it. We all freaked out. We all ran out of the room as fast as we could. And we didn't talk about it much after that, but I have at least 5 other people that witnessed it. And it was very, very freaky. We'd hear noises all the time. Sometimes we would go in there late at night and we would just hit record with mics going in the room, try to get EVPs. It never worked out. But I have multiple experiences from our old recording studio, The Gallows. And once in a while, I'm going to bring it up on this show and let you guys hear it. So I hope you guys enjoyed that. It was crazy. I'm telling you right now, it was the scariest thing I've ever seen. There's no way it could have just fell off of that ledge. It had to actually be pushed out because it didn't just fall off the wall. It shot out into the middle of the room and landed on the floor. So if you guys have any crazy stories like that, I want to hear them. You can email me. You can hit me up on social media at TOTOT podcast, or you can call the hotline and I will maybe feature your ghost story on the show. So, you can call 1-765-372-8818. That is 1-765-372-8818. Let me know if you have a story. If it kind of ties into music, that's even better. Like, I know it's a lame connection, but this happened in my recording studio. So, if you guys have a crazy ghost story, go ahead and call the hotline, whatever. Let me know about it. Maybe I'll feature you guys on the show. But that is going to do it for the intro. I'm going to get into my conversation, but first, please follow us on all of the platforms at TOTOT Podcast. Subscribe, rate, and review wherever you consume this fine podcast. It goes a long way to help with the visibility. And we grow every week, and I just want it to keep going. So if you like the show, throw us a like, throw us a subscribe, share us on Facebook, whatever you want to do, it will help us, and I appreciate it. So without further ado, I'm going to jump right into it. This is my conversation with my good buddy, Mr. Tom Petta from Big Wig and The World's End. Here we go. And I'm on the line with Mr. Tom Petta from Big Wig and The World's End. How are you today, Tom?
Good. Thank you, brother. How are you?
I'm doing well. I feel like it's been years and years since we've actually chatted on the phone.
I know. Yeah, it's been too long, man.
So, good to hear you. Yeah, it's good to hear you too. I've seen you guys have been doing a lot of stuff, playing festivals and whatnot. It's really nice to see Big Wig back in action. So how does it feel to be back out there?
Thank you. It's been cool. It took a long break, I think after 2007, and put it back on the map around 2013. And it's been going really cool, man. I have no complaints. We've been keeping busy and we're writing a new record now.
So you had an accident, correct? You cut your finger. I remember at one point I had talked to you and I was possibly going to come jam with you guys, but like my job schedule was messed up and it just never kind of came together. But I know that you didn't play for a while because you seriously injured your hand, correct?
Yeah, I took some time off. I was making motorcycle parts on one of my friend's rigs. It was like a big industrial saw and the guard let go and it came down and I pulled my entire hand out from it. I probably would have gotten chopped off at the wrist. But it took I would say about a quarter inch of my pointer finger on my right hand, which I hold my pick with, basically.
Yeah. That sucks, man.
Yeah, it came clear off. I went flying into the grease catch, and I didn't get to save it or anything. A couple of my friends basically pulled it out of the grease catch while I was at the hospital and brought it to the hospital on like in a bag of ice and stuff. But I had to make a pretty quick decision with the hand surgeon that they called in. And he's like, listen, I got to sew this up and make it look like a finger, or I can leave it as is and let it heal up. And it was like, it kind of cut a perfect slice in like Gumby's head shape, basically.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. The shape of Gumby's head. So I was like, no, I was freaking out. I was like, isn't there some sort of like remedy that we can do to like regrow the fingertip back? I was, I read something about that, and he's like looking at me. He's like, man, you got 10 minutes to make this decision. And I was like, all right, sew it up. And he took like these scissors and basically started cutting my finger into shape, basically.
Wow.
It was pretty gnarly to watch. And that was brutal. That was a rough one, man. I've been through some shit, but that was a brutal one.
What was the healing process like? I mean, how long was it before you could actually get a pick back in your hand and start playing?
Oh man, months. I don't remember exactly. I'm so horrible with time frames, but I couldn't really do much with it because I guess I would have misshapen it.
Yeah.
I had to let it heal, and I had stitches in it holding it shut at the front of it. I probably didn't play guitar either at all or well, maybe for a year after that. I was trying to use my other, I wasn't even sure if I could use that finger anymore to hold a pick, until it healed completely. And, they did what's called a Y flap surgery, and I don't even understand it, but I have some, I guess they took part of my finger from another part of my finger and made this, a new fingerprint. I don't even understand where they got the skin from, but, it looks pretty normal.
Yeah.
And that guy is an artist because it looks like a fingertip, and I don't even understand where he got the meat or the extra flap from. He was great, man. He's a magician.
So what was it like when you actually started playing again? How out of shape were you? Because, you know, I'm a guitar player, and I know that if I go a month or two without really hitting it hard, like I start to just be horrible on the guitar.
Yeah. I tried playing with the thumb and my middle finger. That didn't work because I have that like kind of, I guess, an Eddie Van Halen style to where I keep the three fingers out instead of my whole hand closed.
That's exactly how I do it too, man. Like completely straight out. Almost like Kirk Hammett, if you ever watch him play.
Yes, totally. And I guess that's my leverage for the fast picking. So I wasn't able to do the middle finger thing. So with my pointer finger, I guess, man, it probably took me a few months to get back to the fast stuff. And to be able to actually hold the pick and feel the pick, because it's a bit numb compared to what it used to be.
Yeah.
And I slowly came back to some feeling, and it's really weird. Like the nail grows a little bit weird. I actually have to carry like a nail file on tour so I can sand it down so it's like the right shape to hold the pick, because the nail gets in the way of the pick. And it's actually kind of a high maintenance finger now, man, just to play guitar.
It would have been cool if there would have been like, you know, some thing that you could do now that you couldn't do before, like your pinch harmonics were just insane because your thumb's numb.
Well, I would, that would be awesome. I wish I was, I wish I had some sort of superhuman power now.
Yeah.
But I will say I'm probably a better guitar player than when I started because I never practiced so much.
Yeah,
I didn't
yeah.
really practice that much before. Not like I didn't need to. I just was lazy, I guess, with it. And when that happened, I was like, there's fucking no way I'm not playing guitar again. So I just hammered down and practiced as much as I could. And I think I'm a better guitar player because of it, actually.
So the one thing I want to talk about, I get into this with, I have guitar players on the show. I'm a pretty, you know, studied guitar player. I teach guitar for a living. I know all my theory, all my modes, all the crazy stuff. You play some pretty ripping, shreddy solos. Like, what is your background as far as the knowledge side of the theory? Is there any there?
That's awesome. I envy that you know that much. I wish I studied and learned more about guitar.
It's a hindrance. It's a hindrance sometimes because when I was younger, I could just jam and shred and do whatever I wanted. Now I'm thinking about ones and threes, and it really hinders you sometimes. You have to find a happy medium between the two.
I can imagine that. I can hang with people as far as playing intricate stuff, but I can't read. I have very little background in music theory, or I don't know notes. I can't read notes. I can't read sheet music. I learned the names of my strings late in the game. Hell, like, I'm just self-taught, and I basically learned from playing old metal records by ear. I do have a pretty good ear, so I think that helped a lot.
The old metal records you were listening to back in the day, I mean, I know that you guys covered a Slayer song in one of the Pop Goes Metal comps. What were some of the bands that really got you into music?
I think the guitar bands, basically, and it was like basically the big four, and I'll throw Pantera in there as the big five.
Okay.
So
yeah.
Metallica, Slayer, Anthrax, Megadeth, Pantera, I guess. And actually, you know, I kind of, when I was a kid, like maybe 12 years old, I really liked glam metal, like White Lion. And even when I was like 10, I probably listened to Poison and Bon Jovi. So those are like great guitar players in some of those bands. I wouldn't call CeCe DeVille the best, but in Bon Jovi, man, you know,
Richie Sambora is great, man. He's great.
Sambora was ripping. Yeah. And like, their bass player is fucking phenomenal.
Dude, I had Ricky Rocket on the podcast last year from Poison.
What?
Yeah. And he was telling the story about, they were going to go with Slash instead of CeCe, but they thought CeCe looked cooler.
Oh man.
Yeah. So I always thought that Slash looked cooler myself.
Yeah. I think Guns N' Roses was probably one of my biggest influences from like maybe 10 to 15 years old.
Yeah.
As far as rock and roll and guitar playing. I mean, I always really liked Izzy and always thought he was a driving force, but he never got that much attention. And I liked Slash, but I mean, his solos were like sloppy and shit, but I still loved him. I'm not like the most accurate guitar player myself, but.
Well, I tell you, living where I live in Indiana, you get a steady dose of the Guns N' Roses because Axl and Izzy are both from Indiana. So.
Oh, that's right. Right.
Yeah.
Oh, that's great. I don't really like Axl's persona or his vibe, but I really do love early Guns N' Roses.
What do you think of like the new vibe and persona? Because it seems like he's on his best behavior. Like he went and did the stuff with AC/DC, and like Guns N' Roses didn't miss any shows. They weren't even late. Like I feel like he maybe has a new perspective on his career, and he's actually trying to play by the book now.
I respect that. I mean, I can't even imagine what those guys went through in the 80s, between drugs, alcohol, addictions, afflictions, and having their asses kissed by giant labels and having that much money at that time and being like forced to tour. So I can't put myself in those shoes, but I think it's cool what he's coming back and doing. I didn't even realize, somebody told me way late in the game that he was singing for AC/DC. I was like, what?
Dude, he killed it too. And I'm saying,
like, I heard.
I've seen some of the videos of the Guns N' Roses stuff with like the original lineup, or at least most of the original lineup back together. And the dude is older and chunkier, but man, he's hitting those notes. It's crazy.
I listened to some of it and I was really impressed. He used to be one of my favorite vocalists, for rock. And, yeah, man. I mean, good for him. Like, we all fuck up in life sometimes, and I'm not going to hold anybody to it as long as you're not doing anything heinous, like hiring somebody to like kill your ex-wife or your wife, that guy.
And they have a new record coming out. We won't give him any press, but it's a pretty Christian hardcore metal band, but yeah.
Oh, it's terrible that people are backing that, but like, yeah, like you said, let's not give him press. That's just shitty. Like anything super heinous or something, I don't back, and I don't want to hear like, you know, Ted Nugent crap.
Yeah.
It's like, you know,
I don't want to hear about how great Trump is.
Yeah. So basically, more power to Axl, man. I mean, he was a big influence of mine. I can't say he wasn't. I don't know about, I'm not saying his character influenced me, but his talent and his style and his edginess. I think his edginess was kind of punk rock at the time. He was saying a lot of shit in lyrics that were pretty gnarly for that time.
Yeah.
And
I just remember when I was young and you got Appetite for Destruction and the inside cover had like the rape scene by the robot or whatever. And I didn't understand it because I was so young. And then later on, I know there's a lot of controversy behind it. And I'm like, man, I was so young to be exposed to something like that.
Completely, man. And I think in Lies, he drops the N-bomb.
Oh, yeah, he does.
I think he calls... one of the quotes is immigrants and pirates. Now I heard interviews of him like trying to talk that off, and I was just like, oh, this makes me so uncomfortable because I don't want to like the band anymore. But there's so many artists that I listen to that are just so fucked up.
Yeah.
And I think that's part of the dynamic of art, is that some of it's just made by fucked up people, or maybe they're just real human beings going through some shit. I just don't agree with it. I wouldn't put it in my music. But I mean, you have the same thing with the Descendants. You know, the Descendants years ago were using some pretty edgy words that I don't agree with. And obviously through interviews, you know, they'll mention that that was them, you know, trying to be funny at that time. And I get it, man. I don't hold people to that stuff. As long as they give an honest explanation or apology, just as anybody should, you know.
Well, and we talk about that quite a bit on the podcast, like separating the artist from the art, because I can't, you know, like Metallica, I talk about them on this podcast almost weekly because I love them, just like you probably love them. They helped you learn how to write music, to play guitar. When I, you know, I found out this new thing about them trying to resell to the secondary market through Live Nation and make more money on the tickets. And I'm like, that fucking sucks, but it's not going to make me not like Master of Puppets, because I love that fucking song. I love that fucking record. So separating the artist from the art. I mean, I grew up in the Midwest. When I was young, Roseanne was one of my favorite TV shows. Everything she said on Twitter was fucking horrible. But when it's on TV, I still find myself laughing because it was part of my childhood, you know?
Sure. Yeah. No, I mean, like, yeah, it's it's uncomfortable and awkward.
Yeah.
And it's like watching a train wreck, but yeah, I don't know how to feel about that Metallica thing either. That's a pretty shitty thing. I don't know how much truth there is to it. I haven't read, I just read a quick, like, you know, something on Facebook. So I'm not going to hold much value to that until I find out that it's valid.
They haven't like made a statement yet. So it kind of worries me, because I figured if it wasn't true at all, they would come right out and say something, you know?
Ah, fair enough. Yeah, but yeah, God, being in the music industry for 25 plus years makes me realize that I'm not sure what the fuck is real anymore.
Yeah.
I usually don't believe anyone, and most of the people are full of shit or have some hand in someone else's pocket to lie about something. So, I don't know.
Have you guys ever had any kind of weird thing that happened at a show, or any lyrics or anything that caused any kind of controversy? I know that's kind of a weird question, but like on the topic that we were talking about.
I wish we were cool enough to have some sort of controversy or conspiracy. Not really. I mean, most of our stuff, I would think, was just my stupid lyrics from maybe the first record were just for jokes and shock value.
Yeah.
I assumed people thought that they realized we were sarcastic, and I think we didn't realize many people would be listening to those songs. So they were they were written towards a very small localized group of like people that kind of understood the joke. Like, we were always joking about, you know, vegetarianism or veganism, but I was a vegetarian.
Yeah.
And all of our friends were like hardcore straight edge, you know, vegans and stuff. They got it. And it was localized jokes, but once it got out there, I think people thought it was like, oh, this guy is for real. And it wasn't for real. It was super sarcasm. But
I mean, I always got funny. The sarcasm, because I always thought you guys were kind of a more tongue-in-cheek kind of sarcastic version of Propaganda as far as that went. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, sure. I mean, that's basically what it was. And I think we got that from a lot of the sarcastic metal bands that we listened to.
Yeah. I'm trying to remember that thing about the stuff bitching about animals or whatever, that thing that was in one of the songs. But yeah, that's awesome, man. So when did you form the band? Was it in, like, it was in the mid-90s, correct?
Yeah, it was more early 90s. Okay. Was when I started to put it together. So I was playing in another band in the local town that I grew up in. We went on a tour. I think we were on a tour with Apocalypse Hoboken, who was one of my favorite bands.
Yeah, great band.
Great band, great dudes. And at that time, that was like my first tour ever. So that didn't go well for me as far as getting along with some of the other members in the band. I quit in Knoxville, Tennessee, and I was like, fuck it. I would just grab my guitars. I grabbed the giant army duffel bag that I had and a Mesa Boogie Mark IIc in a wooden box. So you can imagine how heavy this shit was. And I walked across Knoxville to a train station, and I took a Greyhound home. And then on that Greyhound ride, I wrote Best of Me, which was how frustrating that bullshit was for me.
Yeah.
And that became one of the records, or one of the songs on the first record. And I had called up my best friend Danny at home, who was the first drummer on Merry Melodies. And I was like, hey man, do you want to just put something together and do this right? And let's have some fun. And he's like, yeah, I can't wait for you to get home. Let's do this. So I took like an 11-hour bus trip all the way back and had to move that fucking amp from bus to bus. I didn't get any sleep. It was a crazy ride. I was all bummed out and depressed. I just quit a tour. I don't quit things unless I'm really pushed. So at the time, I guess it was a really like dramatic and hard experience for me. But looking back, it was probably the best thing that I've ever done.
So you got back and you guys started jamming. How long was it before you guys actually recorded something?
So we didn't know what we wanted to do. Me and Dan both grew up listening to like Queen, Metallica, Blondie, Megadeth. Those were our bands. He listened to a lot of Iron Maiden. That wasn't my thing really too much, but yeah. I appreciate him. And like we were always jamming in his basement, like just guitar and drums, like, you know, trying to like cover Master of Puppets songs and practicing to those and like writing our own like, you know, four chord tunes. We listened to a lot of Screeching Weasel actually too.
Is that where the punk influence kind of came in, like in melded with the metal stuff kind of?
Yeah, I think my earliest punk influences were probably the Misfits being from New Jersey.
Oh, yeah.
It was like Misfits and Suicidal Tendencies, I think, were my favorite. And I should have mentioned Suicidal Tendencies as the metal reference, but they were so crossover from hardcore punk. And like I also listened to Mucky Pup.
Okay, yeah.
And there was a local band in New Jersey called IDK who were pretty influential, and like a lot of hardcore bands from New Jersey that I liked.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
So, and those hardcore bands at the time were very metal influenced and kind of breakdown, you know, heavy breakdowns and stuff.
It seemed like a lot of the East Coast hardcore bands had that kind of metal edge to them, you know?
Well, there's no such thing as West Coast hardcore, is there?
I mean, there's some bands that tried.
I'm just kidding. I'm going to catch so much shit for that.
We got a lot of West Coast listeners.
I know. I'm just busting. No, yeah, East Coast hardcore was definitely, some people will call it tough guy, breakdown, you know, stuff like that. I used to love that stuff. I was always the youngest kid with like long hair at those shows. And
well, man, I remember your dreads, man. Your dreads are pretty badass.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, not so badass when you're at like pretty gnarly, like City Garden skinhead populated shows. And,
yeah, I got you.
You're like 15 years old by yourself.
Yeah.
And I was like 6'2", and people, I guess, thought I was older and just probably wanted to kick my ass because of my hair.
And I'm sure like I, the funny thing is I was in a reggae band for a while, and I actually lived in Jamaica for a while. I had a lot of friends that had dreads, and man, on being on tour with no showers, they get pretty raunchy.
They get gnarly, yeah, yeah. Tour was pretty gross.
Is that why you cut your dreads?
Yeah, I got really, really like just sick of them one day and cut them in the van.
I remember like before I actually met you, which we'll talk about that story here in a little bit. I just remember that you had the dreads, and then all of a sudden, I don't even remember how I found out because the internet wasn't even really a thing. But somehow I found out that Tom from Big Wig cut his dreads, and like me and my friends were pretty bummed out at the time.
That's funny and weird.
Yeah, it's kind of weird. It's like when Metallica showed up to Alice in Chains Unplugged, and they had their fresh new haircuts. You know.
Oh, nice. All right. I'll take it. It's just odd when somebody knows that you got a haircut.
I don't even, because I'm saying like the internet wasn't a big thing, but I remember having a conversation with one of my buddies. We were big, you know, we were huge fans from the first record. And like I said, this is years before I met you. And and I was like, I don't remember how we found out, but man, Tom cut his dreads. What the fuck, dude?
I guess that was kind of my signature at the time.
Yeah, well, it's the cap. You wear the baseball cap a lot, so now that's the cap, right?
Yeah. yeah, so I mean, I guess basically those times starting the band was formed around thrash and skate punk. Or I guess what's called skate punk now. I didn't call it skate punk then. And, you know, Misfits, Screeching Weasel, a little bit of NoFX in there, tons of Bad Religion, tons of Pennywise, Suicidal Tendencies. Their first record was like that kind of hardcore record. Like lots of Megadeth. I would say So Far, So Good, So What. And P-Cells, Who's Buying, was like one of my favorite records. The first era of Metallica before Black Record, and some Pantera was thrown in there, man.
So you guys were playing, you know, you're recording stuff. What was the process? Were you guys touring a lot or just playing a lot on the East Coast? What was the process when you guys actually hooked up and got signed? You signed with Fearless first, correct?
Yeah. If I knew then what I know now, I think most of those processes would have been different and probably less desperate.
Okay.
I didn't know anything about touring, and I didn't know that a band could go on tour. I thought you had to be like from LA and have like some booking agent. And then we found, this is after we went through like a couple, I don't want to call it lineups, cause there was no actual band. It was just us jamming and trying to like form a band.
Trying to figure out what the right chemistry would be, correct?
Yeah, I wasn't even planning on singing. I wasn't a singer. I was just a guitar player. So we had like other singers come in and sing. I basically sang by default towards the end just because there was nobody else to.
Dude, I hear that story so many times from people that are on the podcast that are singers. It's like, well, I could sort of carry a tune.
Yeah, and I love it now. I'm glad I did it. I think I was just really self-conscious about my voice at the time and didn't know that it was an option. And I'm really glad I did it because I love being a vocalist now. And I lost track of where we were going.
The getting signed thing in the processes of touring and whatnot.
So the touring started with Book Your Own Fucking Life by Maximum Rock and Roll.
Used it so many times for my old band, man.
Oh, man. What a genius publication. Yeah. And well done, I must say, because I couldn't have organized anything like that at that time. And we started calling up other bands because, you know, people would have their phone numbers in there. There was no internet. So I would just literally call other bands and like, shit, man, we connected with like AFI from the West Coast, and me and Davey were trading demo tapes. We were talking about maybe like doing a tour. I think those guys wrote us and said like, oh, we just had to cancel our tour because we ran out of money. Imagine that.
Yeah.
And I think I've called up other bands from there. I probably made such a jackass out of myself. Just like, I'm so awkward when I like meet somebody sometimes. I was so desperate to just get the band out on the road and to see what it could do. And then we finally started playing some shows. I think we booked our first Florida tour, if you want to call it a tour. And that was with Discount, My Pal Trigger, and In Like Flynn. And I think that was the winter of 95. It was like the Christmas winter of 95. I could be wrong. Might be 94. And I think that's when we just recorded the demo, which later became a remixed record of Unmerry Melodies.
Oh, so they just remixed the demo and like made it a little bit better.
We recorded it in a garage with our friend Andy at New Blue Studios, which was just a garage studio. It was an awesome studio though. And, it was on like 1-inch tape.
Okay.
And so we were playing a hall show with oh, well, we used to throw hall shows. We figured out that was a good idea. We're like, if you want to play with big bands, you might as well just book them and then put your band on the show.
We used to do that in Indiana too, man. We'd just get like a American Legion or something. They go, hey, man, Strung Out needs a tour date. Let's get them.
That's exactly what we did, and exactly the band we did it with.
Oh, awesome.
we played with Strung Out. And Jim Cherry, I love that guy, rest in peace. He watched us play, and he came up to me, and he's like, your band's fucking amazing. You guys are ripping. He's like, what are you guys doing? I was like, I don't know, man. We don't have any plans. We just want to get out there. And he brought me to a payphone, and he called Bob from Fearless, like, right on the spot. And then he just put me on the phone with Bob. He's like, Bob, you have to hear this band. And I was like, I was so awkward. And Bob's like, I'm sure it was pretty awkward for Bob too.
Oh, yeah.
And Bob's like, well, if you're as good as Jim says you are, I'll have the contract out this week. I just need to hear it. And he's like, send me a demo. So we sent him the demo. He really dug it. And literally that week we got a contract from Fearless, and he had us come out to California, and I retracked the guitars and some vocals on the quote demo we did.
Yeah.
But there's really not much different from the demo to the record, other than maybe some guitar tracks.
So what did that feel like? Because, I mean, you know, like, I was in the Ataris for a while. I wasn't in the band when they got signed, but, you know, Chris got signed off a demo tape he gave to the Vandals, you know, to Kung Fu. And you got signed because a guy saw your band and put you on the phone with Bob. I mean, it's almost like a movie. Like, did it just feel surreal to you?
It was surreal because we really looked up to the guys in Strung Out. I mean, they're phenomenal. Not only phenomenal dudes, they're amazing musicians.
The musicianship in that band is unmatched, I would say.
It's unmatched. It's unmatched. And I love each guy separately for all the reasons you can. And just watching the band's energy, and hearing their songwriting, Jason's vocals are phenomenal. I can't say enough about Strung Out.
Yeah.
They took us on our first real U.S. full tour. We split a bus with them, and that was crazy and mind-blowing for me.
Was there ever talk about you guys going to Fat? I mean, Jim at the time was hooked up with Fat. I mean, I just always wondered that, because you guys would have fit with that kind of, you know, ex-Hesher kind of punk rock thing, right?
Right. All right, there's so many things with that. So when I was like a little grom, I used to go to NoFX shows and probably like tug on Mike's sleeve, being like, hey, give me one of those free compilations you got there, buddy. And, you know, he would give his attention, and he heard the demo. I think where that started, I went to a Warp tour, and I just walked right onto NoFX's bus.
Okay.
And Fat Mike and Fletcher were sitting at the table. I'm not saying that was cool of me to do. I probably shouldn't have done that.
Yeah, but you were young. I mean, I'll give you a pass.
I was young, and I think I at least knocked. So I walk on, Fat Mike and Fletch are sitting at the table, and I was like, hey, Mike, check this out. You're going to like this. And he put the tape in, and they actually listened to like two or three songs at the time. And Fletcher was like, yo, this is good, Mike. Why don't you give him a contract now? I know he was kind of fucking around. But I was like, yeah, give us a contract. And Mike's like, this is actually really good. And he's like, let's talk more at a better time, I think. So like later down the road, or Mike, and since that time, Mike's always been really supportive of the band and always complimented it. And he would always tell me, he's like, man, you scream a lot. He's like, I don't like the screaming. It's too like hardcore.
Yeah.
And I'm assuming he didn't really like metal and hardcore at the time. I don't know. I'm not speaking for him. And but with the one thing
he had
I really
to like
do,
metal a little bit, because a lot of those like first wave bands were very metallic.
I agree, and a lot of the early NoFX riffs are pretty, you know, shreddy kind of thrash.
Yeah.
The one thing I've always respected about Mike is he's super honest about music in general. And he'll tell you that I don't like this song, but I like this about it, or I don't like anything about it, or I really like this about it. And for someone who's writing music, that's exactly what you fucking want to hear and need to hear. You don't want people like blowing smoke, like your friends being like, oh, that's a great song. And you know, the song sucks. If you're trying to actually create like a good song and be a songwriter and like grow as a songwriter, you want people to be completely blunt and honest with you. And someone who writes as rad tunes as like him or Fletch or Jimmy from Pennywise or those guys, that meant a lot to me to hear the truth from them. So now, it doesn't mean that you go home and change everything because somebody said,
yeah,
you know, I don't like that song, but it's good to have that input. And it's just another ear on your tune, like a producer almost. And it's free at that time. So, yeah, that meant a lot to me. So we kept in touch and stuff. And, oh, this part sucks.
I'm ready to hear it. It sounds great so far.
There was a point that I was no longer digging what Fearless was doing. So after we were on Fearless for a while, Fearless, you know, was in a garage at that time.
Yeah.
We had Becca Porter was booking us from the garage. Who's like, I love Becca. She was the like Fearless's first booking agent, basically. And we would be sleeping on Bob's, you know, garage floor, and he would be really like supportive of us. But we were kind of clashing in our idea of what I thought was kind of cool and what wasn't from our band. Maybe now I probably should have listened to him more. He's a pretty smart guy, yeah. But I was like young and pretty stubborn and had my own vision. Anyway, we had like a falling out, and I was like, "Fuck this! I don't want to be on your label anymore." I think we had recorded. I think we were already recorded "Stay Asleep," maybe, and then I was like, "Okay, we don't want this record to come out on your label," so I shopped it to Mike at Fat, and Mike loved it. And he's like, I love this. Let's do something. But right almost at the same time, Bob had sold the contract to Joe from Kung Fu Records.
I was wondering, because I know you guys were on Fearless, and then I did it come out on Fearless as well? Because I seem to remember there being like two versions. Maybe they were the same version, but they had two logos.
Nope. It only came out on Kung Fu, okay. But it had like some demo type stuff coming out. One of the songs was released on the Fat Record compilation, Short Music for Short People.
Yeah, I remember that.
Fearless had a couple like demo tape and like CD recordings that came out before the record came out of like, you know, I think Sell Out was on a tape, or the song Sell Out was on a tape. A couple other songs like Falling Down might have been thrown on a compilation somewhere else.
Yeah.
And then, basically Joe from Kung Fu was like, I really want to put this out and I'm going to keep the rights to it. And I was like, no, we don't want to put this on your label. We want to put this on Fat. And I don't know if I called or wrote Mike, but he's like, I grew up with Joe Escalante in Beverly Hills or wherever they grew up. Yeah. And he's like, he's an old friend of mine and I would feel horrible if I took this record from him. And I'm like, I had like the Darth Vader, no. I was like, oh, this isn't where we wanted it to go.
Yeah.
I don't remember all the details exactly of why I didn't have more control or rights over where that record went. But Mike was like, listen, you're only doing one record deals. Like, we only had one record deals with each of these records, basically. We didn't want to sign options. Just in case we wanted to move to different labels.
Yeah.
That's the way we negotiated like every record. So, you know, Mike's like, hey, if you write another record, if I like it, come back to me, bring it back to me. So we ended up mending our, we did not like being on Kung Fu at that time. It was kind of a nightmare and it was definitely not our gig or game. So we went back to Fearless. We made amends with Fearless.
Because Reclamation was on Fearless, correct?
Yes, you are correct. An Invitation to Tragedy.
Oh, yeah, I forgot about Invitation to Tragedy. Yeah, I was in my mind, I'm seeing the Invitation to Tragedy cover, but I'm thinking Reclamation.
No problem. And then Invitation to Tragedy came out on Fearless, and we did that record with Ryan Green mixing it. So we recorded that ourselves with Mike Wooding in Pennsylvania in like this giant warehouse. And then we had Ryan mix it. And I think to this day, that's my favorite production on our records.
It sounds great. The guitars are solid, man. They're big, you know?
Thanks, man. For the early records, I love the production Dan Malsh did on Reclamation, but I just meant for the early records. Yeah, that was my favorite of the top three. And so, I mean, we were happy on Fearless, and Fearless really got their shit together by that time. And I mean, he was killing it. We were getting along with them. We were doing some really great tours. Everything was going good. It was nice for a while. And yeah. And then I had some basically reservations with some of the guys I was playing with, and that kind of held up some other stuff.
Yeah. So because Reclamation was in 2006, and that was kind of the last one before now, this kind of rebirth of the band. So in that time off, what were you doing as far as like for a living? Like, were you doing, I know you're producing stuff and you had like a couple other things going on as far as a studio, but what was your life like in that off time?
I was just recording and producing other bands at that time for like since 2007 on after I stopped touring. So actually that part of my life got really weird. I had a lot of anxiety issues that prevented me from touring. And that's basically like one of the reasons I stopped. A lot of other personal stuff in my life was going kind of weird. And then at the same time was going kind of good to where I wanted to stay home and focus on my family life.
Yeah.
I was touring so much with Big Wig before 2006. Some of the years it was like, I felt like I was on tour for 8 months out of the year.
I've been there, man. It's crazy.
Yeah, I'm sure. No, I know. So you could relate.
Yeah.
And I know to some bands, that's what they want to do. And I'm grateful for that experience, but I'm not sure if that's what I signed up for. And I am grateful for every single show I've gotten to play, but I don't think I want to do 8 months out of the year anymore and then like I missed my dog's life, basically. I've missed, having relationships with friends and girlfriends and my parents. I miss birthdays. I miss weddings. You know the deal. You miss the birth of your family members or the death of your family members.
Yeah.
And at that time, it wasn't Blink-182 money. It was money I'm grateful for, but it wasn't money I can just get on a plane and jump on the plane and go home and see somebody get married and rent a hotel for a few $100. I didn't have that money. Yeah, I just didn't.
You had to basically, if you wanted to survive, you had to stay on tour.
That was it.
Yeah.
And, when I was like 20, we were on tour with Les and Jake, and I caught meningitis, like meningococcal meningitis.
Wow.
If you don't know what it is, look it up. It's a really gnarly fucking disease, and it almost killed me, and it was real. And after that, I was like, I don't know if I want to keep doing this at this level. And after that, I still did it at that level. I was just being pushed and pushed by Fearless and Kung Fu to just keep touring. And not in a bad way. That's what you're supposed to do.
Yeah, they want you to be out there pushing the record that they're putting out. I mean, it's kind of a symbiotic thing. They're doing their job and that's your job. So, I mean, I get it.
It was my job. Exactly. And there was just points where it became not so fun. And just like any human, I started to miss the shit at home. And I was like, hey, I don't know if this is what I want to do. Like, I love making art. I love making music. Just don't know if I want to do it like this at this capacity.
Well, I love the way that you guys are doing it now because it seems like you're touring in a way that allows you to maybe not have it be the full focus in your entire life.
Yep.
I mean, and that's something that I'm kind of looking for right now, because when you and I were talking about, jamming back in the day, I wasn't married and didn't have any kids. Now I have two toddlers and a full-time gig teaching and all this stuff. So I get offers all the time, but it's got to be something that is going to make sense to my life. And I like the fact that you guys have kind of figured out how it makes sense in your life.
First of all, that's awesome. And congratulations to you, because most people don't get that balance. I know how much you worked in music, and the fact that you got married and have kids and you found a balance. A lot of my friends don't find a balance, and it's either due to too many drugs or partying, or they stay out on the road to, be the rock star, which is fine. I respect all of it. But sometimes that's just not the fucking reality. Music's hard. Music sometimes doesn't even matter how talented you are. It doesn't mean you're going to get far. It's just kind of Russian roulette sometimes.
Yeah, totally, man.
And, our band was doing great. I'm grateful for that. And it's still doing great. I'm so grateful to be able to play punk rock and metal or hardcore, whatever you want to call it. And have people come out and watch. I love it. It's fucking awesome. From my finger after meningitis, after taking a hiatus, our fans were still there waiting for new record. I'm still waiting for new record, and I'm slacking on it just because of because I'm trying to find that balance, basically, of, like you said, a balance of life, relationships, other goals that you have in life other than music, responsibilities, priorities, all that kind of stuff.
So one thing that I wanted to talk about, we were talking about touring. I know that you did some tours with No Use for a Name. I'm sure you got to hang out with Tony quite a bit. You know, yeah. Tony's passing was just the anniversary was a couple days ago. I met Tony a few times back in the day, and he was always just the nicest guy. Do you have any stories or anything about Tony you could share with me?
Man, I have a ton, and I'd be happy to. I don't even know where to start with Tony. I don't know him on the level, say, like, you know, a guy like Joey Cape or Fat Mike knows him. Those guys were so close, and you could tell, and that's amazing. Tony taught me so much shit about music that I had no clue about. And he also taught me about that balance of family.
Yeah.
I remember when he was having his kids on the tour in Europe, and he, you know, he was buying gifts for them, and you can tell that he totally missed his family, and it was legit. It wasn't bullshit. I guess the one thing I could say about Tony is how real the guy was and how honest he was in such a cool way to really be like, okay, this guy doesn't look like a punker. Like, he didn't have the fucking mohawk when I was hanging out with him. I'm sure he has at some point.
Yeah.
But like, his attitude was very like, I don't give a fuck what you think about me, but I'm still going to be a classy dude. And his talent was just unmatched, man. His songwriting is fucking phenomenal. His guitar playing was tight. His vocals were angelic. Every time I hear his vocals, I get chills. And like, the guy's range was amazing. You know, not getting too nerdy, but he's a great vocalist. He's a great songwriter. And when you talk to him, he's really humble. He's also really fucking dark and sarcastic and funny, to me at least.
He was like that. I mean, like I said, I met him maybe three or four times over the course of touring. And yeah, man, I mean, everything you're saying is correct. Like, he had that kind of witty, dark sense of humor, which me and my friends all have. So I was like, oh, dude, you should just be in our circle of friends.
Yeah. Yeah. I really appreciate that he took the chance on my band and Matt and Dave and Rory.
Yeah.
Those guys are all stand-up fucking dudes, and they're all really, really talented. I hate the word underrated because it's almost an insult sometimes.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
I think they were too good for Fat Records.
I mean, I can get behind that because it just seemed to me like, I mean, everybody that I let hear that band, because they're a big band for me. They're one of my favorites of all time. And I let people that maybe aren't into punk rock, I let them hear something from them and they like it automatically. Like, it's, I think it kind of transcends what was going on at Fat and Kung Fu and Fearless at that time. Those labels, even Epitaph, it was on another level as far as structure and songwriting was concerned for me.
It really was. And the lyric content was amazing too.
Yeah.
It's rare to have all of those things. And anybody could listen to No Use for Name and be like, that's fucking great.
Yeah.
You know, the melodies, the songwriting, the structure, the odd chord progressions, the playing, Dave's leads, Matt's, like, you know, tri-finger Steve Harris playing, like,
yeah.
I mean, it's just the harmonies, you can't really match that stuff. I mean, to me, Strung Out was that on a whole nother metal type level, like a thrashy version of that. So, I mean, you could see why Fat Records was Fat Records at the time, and what they were pumping out was like, holy shit, man, like, these are great songwriters and releases. And
when you think really about those, like, first four or five bands, I mean, they have Lagwagon, they have Propagandhi, they have Strung Out. No, I mean, how can you miss? That's like the big four, right?
Yeah, I would say Lagwagon, No Use, and Strung Out to me are untouchable as far as the songwriting and musicianship at that time.
Dude, that new Lagwagon record that just came out, I don't know if you've heard it. It's just as good as anything they've ever done.
Nice, nice. Trash is my favorite one by them so far.
Me too,
but
man.
I'll check that out because I know that you have some good taste.
If you like Trash, you're going to love the new one, man. It's great.
Awesome. Awesome. I love the new Strung Out.
Oh, yeah. It's really good too. I just, Vanessa over at Fat just sent me a promo of it. It's crazy, man.
Oh, sweet. Yeah, they're great, man. I mean, I miss that about Fat Records. I miss the quality of that, of their releases, basically.
Yeah, yeah. The new Good Riddance is really good as well. You should just check everything out. I'll send you links.
Oh, I haven't heard that one.
It's pretty cool. Yeah, I was going to say, when I first met No Use, it was on a Warp Tour. I can't remember the year, but Rory tried to teach me how to surf somewhere. I don't remember where awesome. We were at. But yeah, I was horrible at surfing. So I don't know if Rory ever listens to this, but I need to get you on the show and maybe you can show me how to surf again sometime.
He's a great dude. No Use took us to Europe and we split a bus with him, and that's how I kind of got to know them a bit more. And that was a really weird fucking time in my life. I was pretty battered by then. I probably wasn't the coolest person to tour with, and they seemed to put up with me. Tony got me on the plane because I just don't like flying. I will do it, but I don't like flying. I think his thing was he didn't like flying over land. Okay, he didn't like flying over land. And I mean, he got me to a doctor. The doctor got me on some Xanax, and the Xanax got me onto the plane. I don't fucking party with pills or do any of that. And actually at the time I didn't even take like Advils for a headache.
Wow.
So for me to have taken any sort of pill at that time was pretty different for me. But it got me to Europe, it got me back, and I have like literally No Use in Tony to thank for that. Because we had a crazy fucking I didn't know the fan base we had over in Europe until that.
Well, that's like, I think a few years back, I mean, a few years, maybe like 7-8 years ago when I was talking to you, some of my buddies who are promoters down in South America were like bugging the shit out of me to get you to come to South America.
Come to Brazil.
Well, Brazil and Peru and Chile and everywhere. And I remember I talked to you about it a couple times and it just kind of went away. But yeah, man, I mean, you guys, from what I've seen online, I mean, I know you guys are very popular in Canada. I get that all the time because I have so many friends up there and all they talk about is Big Wig. And you guys play up there all the time. But you guys have a huge fan base in South America. I know it's got to be the same in Europe. What about Australia? Do you guys get a lot of like emails and stuff from there?
Yeah, there was like a page to have Big Wig come, a Facebook page to have Big Wig come to Australia made by Australians. I think I have Fearless to credit that for. And Fat Records, because they were internationally distributed, and really pumped us in all those places. And I think we probably should have done more. Like, you know, our Japan tour sold out. We just didn't go to Australia like we should have right after Japan. I guess a lot of bands do that because it's not close, but it's closer. And if you're already out there, you might as well.
Yeah.
We skipped Australia. We also got asked to do, it was an Australian tour. I forget with who. I couldn't go at the time. So I mean, we've done Japan and Europe. We haven't hit South America. I get tons of mail from there. I get tons of mail from Australia. A lot of Australians come to certain festivals and they always introduce themselves and they're like, you guys would do great down there. So, I mean, we're still planning it. It's just, like I said, finding the balance of time.
Yeah.
And, we're self-funded right now, so it's not exactly easy to just go book an Australian tour, especially when you're not on Fat or Epitaph. Those are the bands that get priority to those things.
Yeah, totally, man. So yeah. I want to switch gears a little bit. I know that a couple years back you moved to Tennessee. I know you're doing some bluegrass stuff. You have Tom Petta and The World's End. I know you just played a festival up in Canada with that band and Big Wig. So can you tell me how... like what the choice was to move to Tennessee, and did that influence this new bluegrass thing?
Yeah, I think it was always a kind of a shelved dream of mine to play an acoustic genre that just wasn't like solo acoustic stuff.
Yeah.
I've always liked bluegrass because it's basically,
it's like metal.
it's acoustic metal and punk, right? It's like the punk beat with metal shredding.
Yeah.
On a mandolin, banjo, acoustic guitar, a dobro guitar, and an upright bass, and a fiddle. So, it's the same. It's like Dragon Force on acoustic, basically. The guys I play with in Nashville, New Jersey, and Montreal are absolutely phenomenal shredders. I can't keep up sometimes. I just sing and play a guitar in that band. And I learned so much that I just never learned in punk rock about music and about playing. So it's a very cool dynamic, but it still has the exact, it gives me the same feeling and has the same energy as playing in a punk band.
I mean, I watched one of the videos of you guys, and that's kind of the thing that got me. Like, I've never been huge into bluegrass. I like it and respect it, and I know how badass the players are, but I watched a video of you guys playing, and it felt like a punk show. I mean, like, just how you guys were
thanks,
playing.
Man.
The energy was there, the speed, like, the passion for what you were doing. So I think it's really cool that you have these almost polar opposite genres, but they mesh. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I think one of the problems is if someone's not familiar with bluegrass, they hear a banjo and a fiddle and they assume it's country, and that puts them off because a lot of country really does suck.
Yeah.
And some bluegrass is basically played by older people because it's been around for so long and they happen to be like the top notch of their class. So they have an older fan base that grew with them. So there's lots of bluegrass festivals and shows that have older people sitting in chairs. It's very mellow. It's very proper, and that's totally cool. I respect the shit out of that. That's going to be punk rock in another 20 years, hopefully. But there's also another side of bluegrass that has a huge part in the jam scene. The Grateful Deadheads and Fish people, like Fish fans.
Yeah.
There's a jam bands that play bluegrass, and then there's like kind of criminal bluegrass or younger version bluegrass too. And then you have your folk punk guys and gals that cross over into that genre a little bit. And I think there's so much of it that it's hard to kind of pinpoint what bluegrass is exactly these days. But I'm trying to basically just get it out there as high energy and keep it traditional instrumentation wise, and keep some energy.
Have you found that, your core fan base from Big Wig has been accepting and is kind of digging the stuff you're doing with the bluegrass band?
Yes. And thankfully, because, I didn't want to write off any of the punk or Big Wig stuff and like ride on that coattail, but I think it was an easy in. Even though I didn't push it to that crowd, I pushed it to an actual bluegrass crowd who did take well to it and was like receiving it well. And it just seems like it's crossing over into both. And I'm pretty stoked about it because I get to show my version of bluegrass to the punkers. And I think my version of bluegrass is pretty aggressive compared to what traditional bluegrass is to, old bluegrassers. And I've been getting compliments on that. So it's really cool. I mean, keep in mind too, man, I'm playing with top-notch, well-respected bluegrass players that have been around way before me playing bluegrass. They kick so much ass, and they're such good people. It's just a blast to play with. I love playing with the guys in Big Wig and the guys in World's End and gals in World's End. It's just so much fun. I just love playing music.
That's awesome. And you guys, do you have a release out now, or is it being released soon?
I had to add some fiddle to a couple songs, but I have an EP coming out for the World's End. And basically I'm hoping to get that out by fall. It should be like 6 or 7 songs. I'm mixing that.
Is that just self-released, or are you working with a label, or?
I've been talking to a couple labels, so I never know.
Yeah.
It's always so last minute with that stuff. You know how that goes.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
I have a couple offers, and it's really weird. I've noticed with labels lately, they're not too stoked on paying for your recordings, but they want to pay for the pressing.
Yeah.
And I'm like, why? How could you call yourself a fucking label if you don't go all in? Like, I don't want to pay for all this and do all the work, but I don't know. I don't know what's going to happen with it.
So I wanted to tell you a story. I was going to do this earlier in the podcast, but we kind of got sidetracked. So the first time that I ever met you was actually my first ever band, high school band, Chronic Chaos, opened for you guys in Indianapolis.
And hell yeah.
We talked for a little bit, but it wasn't like anything big. Then I met you a couple years later in Canada when I was with this band called Sewing with Nancy that later became The Reason. And we did a lot of shows with you guys up in Quebec, like Rimouski and Sherbrooke and places like that.
Oh, yeah.
I just wanted to tell the story that I remember that you right away wanted to hang out with me and be my friend because I had American Camel cigarettes.
Oh man, I've quit smoking since then, and I hope I keep off the cigs.
Yeah, yeah. I'm still doing it whenever, you know, sometimes. I'm not doing it as much as I used to, but I mean, I just remember when every time I would go with The Reason or Song with Nancy, whatever they're called back then, I don't even remember. But every time I would go to Canada, I'd be up there for like 8 to 10 weeks. So I would just sneak across as much as I could. I'd have like 8 cartons of Camels.
Oh, yeah, man.
You and the other guys in Big Wig, everybody that smoked found out I had Camels, and you guys were my best friends.
Yeah, those Camels are, those are really gold up there, apparently.
Yeah, yeah, they're crazy, man. So I've had you on the phone for a really long time. Is there any new music for Big? I know you're working on music for Big Wig, but is there a plan to release it? Are you going to do like singles like a lot of bands are doing, or are you going to do like another full length?
I have 2 full lengths and an EP written. We have a cover EP that we've been working on and picking songs for that. Those songs keep switching. We've taken so long to put everything out basically because of funding. And that's it. I mean, that's the honest truth. We just, we don't know where to start with the funding. I have tons of material, and it's stuff that I'm really happy with. I think it's some of our best stuff, and I'm excited to get it out there. I just don't want to get it out there on some lame level. I want it to be good. I want to record it well.
Do you feel like with the resurgence of, like I was telling you, the new Lagwagon is kind of like old school Lagwagon, and the Good Riddance album is like old school Good Riddance. Do you think that there's a chance that a label like a Fat or a Fearless would put this new stuff out? I mean, do you guys still have a working relationship with them?
Yeah, we still talk to Fearless. They're a completely different genre, though.
It's all pop, weird stuff now. I mean, it's stuff that sells, I guess.
Well, some of it. I just went to go see August Burns Red and Silverstein in Nashville the other night. And man, August Burns Red is a fucking heavy
band. They're great, man. Yeah, yeah. I've seen them live. Yeah. They're great.
They're on Fearless, and they're super happy on the label. Except, you know, that label's basically pumping out things like that. And I don't know how much room they have for a band or a need or a want for a band like Big Wig anymore, even though, you know, we basically started with the label. I have no objections to any of the labels you mentioned. I like the releases on Epitaph. I like the releases on Fat Wreck. I like the people at Fat Wreck. I like the people at Fearless. We're not against it. It's a matter of getting good demos on tape to where I guess they could hear them first.
Have something to actually present to them.
Yeah. And, you know, I've been hearing like the budgets that some of those labels have been giving bands, and man, I don't know how some of these bands are doing it. It's,
because
studios are still expensive. The budgets are lower. With people stealing music, it's hard to sell records.
Do you still have your equipment? Like, are you still recording stuff on your own, or is it always going to somebody else's studio?
I'll do most of it. I don't have a drum room anymore. And don't want one. I don't want the overhead or the responsibility. So we go to other studios for drums, and then sometimes I'll import it back into my pad or my studio stuff. Recently I had a disaster happen at my house. So my house in New Jersey, where most of my gear was, and it got all destroyed. So that's my new dilemma that I'm trying to work on. I think we're going to probably crowdfund this new record, if that's a good option. So we're looking at that.
A lot of people are doing that, man. I mean, I wouldn't see why not. You guys, I mean, if hell, your fans in Canada could probably pay for it 4 times over.
I think the Canadian thing's a myth.
It just seems like, okay, every time I've ever been up there, no matter what province I was in, I used to have this Big Wig hoodie, and I also had a Big Wig shirt, and people would point it out everywhere that I went. And I know you guys play up there, all those big festivals. I just feel like Canada is your main spot right now.
I don't think so. I mean, when we go to Florida, it's the same. When we used to play California, it was the same. New Jersey. And we used to play all those big fests in the East Coast.
Yeah.
I see what you mean, and I'm not downplaying Canada at all. I think the music scene up there is generally more receptive than anywhere in the United States that I've been.
Yeah.
For every band. I don't think it's just for Big Wig. Yeah, I mean, you know, we still play, I guess, comparing it to like, you know, a 20,000 person festival, we play like 100 to 200 cap rooms up there. You know, it's not maybe what everybody thinks it is. And but they're fucking diehard fans about music in general, man. I love the energy in Canada, Ontario, and Quebec especially. And we grew up, 5 to 6 hours south. So I've never considered, you know, from the beginning or the inception of Big Wig, when you live in New Jersey at the top of like North Jersey, you're only 5 hours from Quebec.
Yeah.
That's right above New York for us. So on a tour, it's local. It's almost local. So even though it's like, quote, international, it's right there. And it's easy to get to. And the people are warm and receptive just like anywhere else. So I think that's why we always went. And if you go south, we had North Carolina and South Carolina, which sucked for us. So why go south? You know, because you have to go all the way to Florida and Georgia for us.
Yeah.
Delaware, nobody came to see us. Baltimore was pretty cool, but not too many other places in Maryland were that great. Virginia was okay. The Carolinas sucked for us. So we would mostly go west and north.
Have you guys played out west recently at all?
No, we've been trying to plan something for a while. A couple hiccups in it, but I mean, we're trying to get out there for, I think, like 5 dates.
Cool. Okay, so I've got one last question, and this is kind of the weird question. It's not music related at all. Now, right, I've spent a lot of time in New Jersey, and I know that's where you're from. I have a lot of friends out there. Now, I like weird stuff like aliens and you know, like cryptozoological stuff. What is your opinion of the Jersey Devil?
Oh, I live in that hood.
That's why I ask. I know you live in that hood.
Yeah, the Jersey Devils, what is it, Mother Leeds? Is that or Mother? I forget. I don't know too much of the history. I just know, like, you know, the short versions of the myth, or maybe not myth. She's only the birthplace of the New Jersey Devils, like 15 minutes from my pad.
Wow.
I think it's cool. I think it's a cool story. I don't know how it came about. I've heard some strange noises in the Pine Barrens, you know.
Do you have any friends that have had like experiences, or do you know people that have actually said they've seen it?
I want to tell you I do, but I really don't.
Okay. I mean, that's fine. I just thought, you know, I don't get to talk to a lot. I talk to a lot of people from New Jersey, but not your part of New Jersey, you know?
Right. Yeah. No, it is popular down there. And actually, I don't really hear the locals talking about it too much. So maybe that's why I'm not well versed in it. Okay. I've been right up to the house though. We've gone and explored, and it's all pretty cool and creepy and fun. We'll usually cruise by on Halloween.
That's awesome, man. Okay, well, I've had you on the phone for a long time. I'm gonna let you go. Enjoy your evening. Is there any dates or anything you would like to plug for the band?
I don't know when this will be out, but I think our only next booked venue is Envol at Macadam up in Quebec City with Lagwagon and the Subhumans.
Awesome. That's going to be great.
In September.
Awesome. And do you have, like, and, is there, you guys going to be playing a lot of shows before the year ends?
We're hoping to. We just have to basically find what regions we're going to be playing in and then book them. So we plan on having a pretty busy year because this will be our anniversary for the band, and it was 20 years of Stay Asleep. Our second record.
Awesome. Are you guys going to maybe do what every other band does and play the entire record?
That would be awesome. That's an idea.
That would be awesome.
We're open to it. If somebody wants to hear it, we'll do it, man. I love that record. I love playing our stuff. So I'd love to do it.
What are the socials for my listeners to check out the band? Do you know those offhand?
Oh man, we're so fucking lame with all that stuff. We don't have a website. We work off of Facebook platform for pages, for our band pages. Instagram, I don't give a fuck about Twitter because I can't figure out how to use it.
I'll just find all this stuff and put it in the show notes so they can check it out. They can also Google Big Wig. I'm sure it'll come up.
Yeah, hopefully it should be easy.
Well, I just want to thank you so much, Tom. It's great catching up with you, man. I love the band. I'm always going to be a fan. And I know we've talked in the past. Hopefully, I got my fingers crossed, someday in the future, if you ever need a guitarist, maybe it'll work out, man.
Well, miss you, man. I'd love to hang. Let's do that soon. And thank you so much. It was fun.
Cool. I will talk to you soon. Have a great night, my friend.
All right, brother. Thank you.
Bye. So there it was, my conversation with Mr. Tom Petta from Big Wig and The World's End. I hope you guys enjoyed that. And yeah, I had to ask him about the Jersey Devil because he lives in that area of New Jersey. I've always liked the paranormal stuff, so I had to ask Tom about the Jersey Devil. But thank you guys for coming back this week and checking out my conversation. I love doing this podcast, and it means a lot to me that so many of you out there care, and I get emails all the time, and it's just, it's really cool. So thank you guys for being a part of this little community that we've started. On the program next week, this is a big one for me. I'm very excited. Mr. Scott Radinsky, Major League Baseball relief pitcher and awesome frontman of Poli. He was also in 10-Foot Pole. Scott was such a great guy. We had such a great conversation. We touched on baseball. We touched on the band stuff. We touched on everything. So you need to come back next week for my conversation with Mr. Scott Radinsky from Poli and Major League Baseball. He's the first actual professional athlete that I've had on the program. Well, I mean, Rick Thorne's professional athlete. There's been a guy. I guess Wee Man was a professional athlete. The first actual, I guess, Major League like commercial sport professional athlete. And he's also one of my favorite singers in punk rock. So come back next week for Scott. And I love you guys. Send in your top five lists and your ghost stories, the new segment, Ghost Stories from the Gallows. You can call the hotline 1-765-372-8818, or you can email us TOTOTpodcast@gmail.com, @TOTOTpodcast on all of the social media platforms. Hit us up, talk to us, let us know who you want on the show. Give me a suggestion for a guest. We have some amazing guests coming up in the future, but I'm going to get out of here. It's late, I'm tired, and I want you guys to enjoy this, and the sooner I get it done, the sooner I can upload it and give it to you. So before I get out of here, as always, I'm going to play some music. I'm going to play one of my favorite Big Wig tunes. It is off of their last full-length record that came out in 2006 on Fearless Records. That album was called Reclamation, and the song that I want to play is called Rat Race. It has some shreddy guitar stuff, amazing bass line, the vocal melody's awesome, the drums are thunderous. I think you guys are really going to like it. If you're not already associated with Big Wig, I think this song could get you into it. They also have some poppier stuff too. They are a great band. If you guys like pop punk, metal, hardcore, thrash, whatever you like, there is a Big Wig song that you will dig. So make sure to check them out. And I'm out of here. This is Rat Race by Big Wig. I'll see you guys next week. Peace. We'll be right back.
Bowie, Dylan, Marley. You've heard the names and maybe you've heard their songs, but what about the stories behind the records that made titans of music like these so universally loved and important? Join me, Josh Adam Myers, host of The 500, as each week I go through a different album from Rolling Stone Magazine's 500 Greatest Albums list from 2012 with an incredible lineup of comedians, actors, and musicians, talking about how the music has impacted their lives. New episodes of The 500 come out every Wednesday. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.